This is the Catholic Movie Guy Podcast.
The voice you hear is not the voice of a supernatural being, but me, the Catholic Movie Guy. At my side, near my side, is...
It's me, the Tin Man.
Him, the Tin Man. The people are clamoring. Not that they don't love my guest stars, but they want, you know, they want Tim. The people love Tim.
Yeah, I've never experienced that in real life.
Nevertheless, it's true, you know.
In the words of Bob, I would say that I'm all used up and the fields have turned brown.
Did you see that guest host? No, no one hosts but me. Guest star Bo, the Master Bonner, called you out on the Facebook, the cookbook?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what that's
Do you have anything you'd like to say?
Yeah, I mean, you know, this, like I said, this childish adherence to Flannery O'Connor in the face of Whoa! All...
All right, that's it. We're not gonna besmirch old Flannery, God rest your soul. So what we are gonna do though is talk about yet another Coen Brothers movie. The people are not clamoring for that, but they're gonna get it and they're gonna like it because it's not what they want, Tim. It's what they need.
President Trump.
Miller's Crossing, the 1990 neo noir gangster flick. What do you think?
It's pretty, real good.
Putatively Tim's favorite Coen Brothers movie.
It's my favorite Coen Brothers movie.
Yeah, I'm still skeptical, ladies and gentlemen, but nevertheless a great film, so we'll get deep into that. Is there anything that interesting happened to you this week? Anything you'd like to discuss? Any, you know, outside of typical podcast discussion you'd like to engage in first before we start things off?
Yeah, you know... I experienced quite a bit of winning this last week, and we kept winning and winning, and then I got to be so much winning, I was tired of winning, and I said, no, no more winning. And then President Trump said, no, we have to keep winning.
And I think that this podcast is the cherry on the cake.
Yeah.
Do you put cherries on cakes?
No.
Miller's Crossing. Plot summary. Go.
It ostensibly deals with the macro situation of two rival gangs, possibly a gang within a gang. But essentially it's a town where an Irish boss, Leo O'Bannon, runs things. One of his capos, an Italian gentleman, Johnny Casper, is getting a little bit too big for his britches. It takes place in Prohibition era. You're not really sure what city it is. But it deals with the... The macro level is a deal between the fight between Leo and Johnny Casper, but in reality it deals with principles of loyalty and love and intrigue and what it means to be a man and how far you're willing to go to act ethically. The real star of the show is played by Gabriel Byrne as Tom Reagan, who's sort of the right-hand man of Leo.
A handsome man.
He is very handsome, and he tries to convince Leo to act in ways that he does not wish to act, because he's being compromised with a love interest, the great Marcia Gay Harden. Marcia Gay Harden.
Great.
No, she's not that great. Yeah, but she's okay. But she's pulling the strings, and he's protecting some complete. I don't know what you call him. Well, they call him the Shmata. I'll call him the Shmata.
And John Turturro. I looked up what Shmata means.
Yeah.
It's a raggedy, bad piece of clothing.
Yeah, he's a real piece of work, as my wife would say, but not in a
good way. As our canon, our priest would say, he's cheap jack.
Yeah, I would say something else, but it's the Catholic Movie Guy podcast.
That's right,
I'm trying to control my language.
And don't forget it.
But anyway, John Turturro plays the part just beautifully, and I don't know, without giving away spoilers, it ends up with a stunning denouement of what it means to really be loyal, what it means to really love, and what it means to be a man.
So we're going to traverse the entire movie, and at the end we will have a spoiler section because I do want to discuss some of the moral and thematic implications. However, we are going to go through the movie, so as usual, I would encourage everybody, if you haven't seen it, to see it. Moral provisos apply. There's
a lot of
language, a lot of violence, of a stylized variety.
And the film is beautifully shot, beautiful cinematography, and a great soundtrack.
And one antique body... Possibly nude photograph. I don't know.
That was in the boxers. Yeah. Really, it's
pointless.
You wouldn't even
and
notice
glimpsing,
it.
But yeah.
If you take your reading glasses off, you wouldn't see it.
So anyway, yeah, I mean, I have to, before we get started, give a shout out to what I think is the definitive take on this movie, or at least it's not really like a review so much as a complete dissection of the movie in all of its glory by Christopher Orr of The Atlantic. So if you're really interested in some of the finer points of the movie, he offers a great take. And to him, it's his favorite Coen Brothers movie, just like with you, right?
Are you putting a link to that on your
podcast page? I could include a link in the show notes, for sure.
Bingo.
For the people.
Bing.
Are they that lazy, though?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I'll do it. So, I want to just highlight a few things about the movie to start, okay? First, it came out the same year as Goodfellas, and it was a complete box office flop. The Coens had just come off of Raising Arizona and, on a very small budget, had had commercial success. I think that movie, to this day, is still a... It's something like that you really can't live in America without seeing some scenes or knowing about Raising Arizona, even if you don't know it by name. It's kind of in the milieu of the time period. So they come off of that success. They get a bigger budget. They decide to do this neo-noir... Philip, what's his name? Dashiell Hammond. Man, it's not it's not like a word for word.
It's evocative.
It's evocative. Take on his book, The Glass Key, and I mean, it just flopped, and I don't get it. Like, this movie is superior in every way to Raising Arizona, aesthetically, right?
And it's superior to Goodfellas.
I actually agree with you. I think it's a better movie than Goodfellas, but we are Coen honks, so I'm trying to be objective here. It's certainly not as, like, start-to-finish entertaining as Goodfellas.
Wrong again.
This is my take.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. To me, it's not as start-to-finish entertaining as Goodfellas. It clearly hasn't made the critical impact or the cultural impact that Goodfellas did for whatever reason. We can talk about that. But more than that, I it's a joy to watch. It's immaculately made. The dialogue's wonderful. It has that kind of Coen Brothers dialogue that you feel like you're in this culture that doesn't really exist. No one would ever speak like this, no one ever did, but it's evocative of a culture that existed at that historical time period and yet has flourishes of verbiage that only the Coens can make. Nevertheless, there is something about it that didn't stick with people, right?
It's too classy. It has a dignity. A dignity and a class that modern man does not have, nor values.
Sounds like you're kind of giving modern man the hi-hat, don't you think?
Of course.
But yeah, I see your point. We watched it in our film club, and it played really well, which I was a little skeptical about because, in a certain sense, it's slow for a gangster movie. There are long scenes of nothing but talking, sitting, long tracking shots, surveys of the scenery, the shots in the woods that are beautiful. The score itself is gorgeous. I agree with Christopher Orr when he says it's the Coen's best score. Because it just, that one theme that he plays on, Carter Burwell, the guy who did the score, and does variations of it. I don't know what that movie is like without that, but to me, that alone, it's closest to, like, if I had to compare score for score, it'd be The Godfather. It has a dignity and a formality while also an emotional resonance that just elevates the material.
Elevate is a good word because there's an aspiration to that score. Your heart is lifted. You don't even know why. And all the underlying currents of morality, loyalty, love, and duty, that is what that movie is about.
Right. And it goes to underscore, pun. How important score and music is to a movie, and it's usually not something that you are self-conscious of when you're watching it.
Right.
I made a point to try to watch it with that in mind, and it's just wonderful. Especially the moments when he's in the woods,
mm-hmm.
and without giving away what happens, when he's faced with serious moral decisions or serious consequences of his decisions, you know, it's almost like a prayer going up as he's experiencing these things. It's incredible.
Midway through my life's journey, I find myself lost in a dark wood, for I had left the path that does not stray.
Dante. Yes. Yeah, but it's not really that dark. It was kind of green. It was kind of bright.
Okay.
It was a little dank. It was a little
wet. The dark forest of error.
Yeah. But yeah, for whatever reason, this movie clearly played well with a bunch of middle-aged guys to young guys. Why did it not catch on? I mean, let's just take... I don't know how it was promoted or anything like that. But I guess, like, maybe the world wasn't ready for it at the time because, and this is another non-original idea that largely comes from Christopher Orr, it's not so much a gangster movie in the way that Donnie Brasco is, like a story about real-life mobsters. It's a commentary on the genre of gangster films from like an outsider's perspective, kind of like Hail Caesar was on like Golden Age Hollywood films from an outsider's perspective, in the sense that it takes conventions and it of that genre, it plays with them, it gently mocks them, it elevates them beyond it from a place of love from people who truly understand what where it comes from.
Yeah, it's an art piece. It's really a beautiful film.
And as I'm saying that, one of the other unique aspects is it's not just a gangster film. It also combines that Dashiell Hammond, Raymond Chandler, noir.
Yeah.
Pot, you know, what do they call them? Hard potboilers? What do they call those?
What do they call those things?
Hardboiled detective fiction.
Yeah, the wise guy, the detective, you know, figuring stuff out, the snappy it's dialogue.
It's a unique blend of the gangster film and that, which also may have alienated people. Oh, another alienating factor, the language itself, which is so cool and so believable for this world they've created, but also incredibly dense, not just in terms of, like, the jargon itself, but also the information they're conveying in and the double crosses and who's with whom and who's really, you know, getting one over. It can be overwhelming.
And, you know, look, this comparison only goes to this particular point. I wouldn't take it any farther, but not a lot of people in modern times love to go see Shakespeare plays. Those are dense with dialogue that's sort of artificial and contrived, and it's beautiful to listen to, but it's not easy. It's not beep you, go get him. You know what I mean? It is poetry.
Right. And also, in the same way, and you know, this is much more comprehensible to modern man than Shakespeare for obvious reasons, but in the same way, it's a stylized version of a real language that is internally plausible and wonderful.
Yeah. To me, its counterpart with the Coens is True Grit.
I would contrast this dialogue to, say, Quentin Tarantino in a completely different way. When you're watching Tarantino's dialogue, it's really cool, and it's cool that characters are speaking this way, and you kind of fall in love with it. That's, like, what is interesting you in the movie is the dialogue. And that's cool. You know, I'm not saying when he's at his best, so he can make some truly excrement films, okay? But the best of him. With the Coens, it's not like that. It's in service of the plot. Sometimes it does stand out because it's so great. But it's always believable within the plot and never just talking to talk, you know? It's not the main star of the show. Do you agree with that?
Yes, more or less. It's like in a Shakespeare play. When you read it, it's like total poetry from another time. But if you hear it performed live, it really, you lose track that they're speaking in iambic pentameter, and it just becomes part of the thing. It serves the plot. It's just what it is. It adds to the beauty, but in a background way.
Right, and that's just another, I know it's like a Coen love fest, this podcast, but they do everything well. They don't just do one thing well. They make it all serve the whole. We talked about how this came out with Goodfellas, right? I would say of the guys that watched this movie last night, even the ones that enjoyed it, probably most of them would say Goodfellas is way better. I think, you know, the critical consensus would say that. I wouldn't. Why do you think... that it was more successful and that it's generally perceived to be a better film, Goodfellas versus this?
I can't speak to the last part, why it was appreciated. I mean, you want to say something like, oh, you know, there's this gory comic violence in Goodfellas, but there was plenty of that in Miller's Crossing. It didn't seem to be the focal point, but there was lots of violent scenes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the Leo scene you'll talk about later.
We can talk about it now. That's one of the most gruesome deaths on film. Yeah, I mean, Leo basically he's getting ready to be offed, and he takes out all comers with his Tommy gun through his house, through the street.
He hops on the porch and he goes down. Yeah. And he shoots a guy up in the window, and he must have put 170 bullets through this guy.
Yeah, the gun never runs out of ammunition. But that's the other, like, that's gory in a sense, but it's also so stylized that you're never like taking pleasure in some real feeling killing.
No.
It's so stylized it has to be fake. The ammunition would have run out long ago, all that sort of thing.
No, that thing was brilliant because it shows Leo's absolute courage and why he you see in that one film, and otherwise in the movie he shows weaknesses and stupidities and that he's old and maybe losing it. But in that one scene, you realize in that one scene why he ran that town for whatever many decades he had run it before, and they don't have to say anything. It's like, yeah, Leo's a bad man.
Mm-hmm. Maybe, I mean, Goodfellas is more realistic. It's based on a real story. Maybe it's just more down to earth, and the characters are all...
And Goodfellas bites on the Godfather. I mean, everybody loved the Godfather, and Godfather films are great. Two-thirds of them.
Whoa.
Three-fourths. Whatever. The point is, it is the same group of people they're documenting in Goodfellas at a slightly later time, whereas the Irish gang that runs the town is hardly ever covered in film. It's not really about the gang at all.
Yeah, so I think that's
it's more relatable.
The real answer is Goodfellas is just a great, you know, a really well done gangster movie, and this is something.
And if you love The Godfather, this reminded you of it, and it's some of the same characters.
It has homages to it too. I mean, the beginning scene where Johnny Casper's talking to Leo is very evocative of the guy, you know, the day of my daughter's wedding at the beginning of Godfather.
The beginning scene with Casper and Leo and Tom is the movie. You watch that one scene, that is what the movie is about. You listen to Casper, the movie is about that.
Right. I mean, it was a joy to watch. It's also hilarious, like every Coen Brothers film, no matter how serious, there's so much slapstick in it. The disciplining of the portly child,
yes,
and by Casper. And, you know, but even in doing that, like, you see he's a complete maniac, but he literally loves his kid. Like, it shows so much about the character. He indulges him and he loves him.
There are two kinds of Southern Italian women. There's the Sophia Loren type, and then there's the Johnny Casper's wife type.
Yeah, Johnny Casper's wife. I don't know who you are. If you're out there, maybe you listen to the Cat the Movie Guy podcast. I'm sure you're a fine lady, but no Sophia Loren.
She big.
The other scene where Tom's getting ready to get his comeuppance by one of Casper's henchmen, a gigantic man, and he instead breaks a chair over his face, and the guy's like, "Tom." You know, like, he's just not even mad, he's just disappointed, like, Tom's trying to fight back, and I'm trying to give him a little roughing up, you know? It's just hilarious. And then when the one scene there, the cops bust in to break up the whole thing going on, and Tom gets knocked out in this process. And 10 seconds of screen time go by, but there's a hard cut from when Tom gets knocked out to when the policemen are, you know, waking him up by dunking him in water. Blah, blah. And what does he say exactly?
He says, "Where am I?" He goes, "You're still here. You're in the same place you were that you passed out 10 seconds ago."
The same place you were 10 seconds ago. Yeah. And it was actually 10 seconds of screen time, and that's just the Coens again playing in a great way, and not in a show-offy way with the conventions of cinema, which is like you see a hard cut from somebody getting knocked out to when they wake up. You don't know how long has passed, but it's definitely several minutes, hours, days. And it was the exact time frame that you were watching the movie.
One thing I just noticed when you were describing the scene is that there is a great similarity to that scene when the police come in to bust up the beatdown. And the scene in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, when they come in with a rail to take old Homer Stokes out.
Yeah, you're right.
The chunk, 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 chunk. Yes, the stamping of the feet of the mob coming in. It was very evocative.
Yeah, and you know what else it reminded me of, Tim?
Joe?
From another classic.
Joe Mama?
Not Joe Mama.
Okay.
That's also Jemima Mama.
Okay.
It reminded me of Jingle All the Way when the cops bust up that fake Santa shop where they're making these black market toys.
And
they say,
also,
"The Grinch is coming, the Grinch!"
It also reminded me of that time when they did the conga line in Metropolitan during one of the New Year's Eve parties.
I thought we had moved past this. I thought we made progress. It's been a while.
You know, I have to throw in a little shout out for Metropolitan by Whit Stillman, the greatest movie that you'll ever see.
Sorry, I was coughing, or else I would have bailed him there again. But luckily, I didn't, so you're still on the podcast. Congrats.
Hey, excellent.
All right, let's go to some spoiler action now. So if you don't want any more spoilers of this movie, take a break, go watch the movie,
spurlers.
And come back. Yes, spurlers. That's great. I love how you do that letter thing that you do. That's really funny.
Yeah.
Or as I like to say, Fernie.
No, it's just funny.
Spoiler time. Okay. The movie's all about ethics within an unethical world, right? A criminal enterprise, which, you know, like we know from the law...
criminal enterprise is beside the point.
Let me get there, bro.
Okay, buddy.
Get it, bro. Hey, bro. Slow down, bro.
Whatever.
We know from the world of law, like, you get involved in an illegal activity, like illegal gambling, and you have a contract in that world. It's not honorable. You can't. It's void. You know. You can't enforce it in a court of law. I look at gangster movies in the same way, because some people say, well, how can you watch this gangster film and glean something out of it? They're all doing these immoral things, blah, blah, blah. You know the premise going in is that it's an immoral world, and no one approves of this, okay? Within that, when you've accepted certain ground rules, who is the good guy, who's the bad guy, who's trying to more or less obey a moral law, right? So Casper's whole thing in this movie is, it's a matter of ethics.
Ethics, loyalty, you know, and, you know, you can count on people. You know, if you can't count on a fix, what can you count on?
Right. They're fixing boxing matches, right. And he's complaining that the fix isn't fair because someone's fixing the fix.
Right. Somebody's leaking information that's putting him in a bad spot where he's chasing bad money, and he wants Leo to hand over this guy. Leo won't do it because it's the brother of his love interest, Verna.
Yeah.
Who also happens to be Tom's love interest, Verna.
Right. And the bottom line here is it's ridiculous to be upset that your fixed fight wasn't fixed after all.
But, you know, the way he acts throughout the entire movie, he always seeks the good in people. He's fantastic.
So when we're looking at the morality of the movie, it's basically about loyalty, right? I mean, Tom being loyal to Leo, despite, in a way, submissive to his authority, despite what he views as foolishness on his part.
Yes.
I mean, that's a very Catholic theme. Now, the actions that he takes to accomplish what he sees as truly making amends to Leo, truly being loyal, are immoral. But within this milieu, it's a lesson of, you know, how to even put aside your self-interest for someone that you're under and someone that you respect.
And the value of the virtue of prudence.
Yes, he is prudent. In everything he does. It's like when our Lord...
In the best of the sense.
Right. Our Lord says, you know, be as wise as serpents, etc. The prudence of the unjust servant, for as much as he did wise. That's this movie and any movie that's in an immoral milieu. We don't have to say that this character was moral, but we can praise insofar as Tom, in his field, was wise, prudent, and exercised a certain amount of virtue in his conduct within that immoral milieu. There are lessons to be had. And I think, you know, regardless of each individual action, the fact that he remains loyal to Leo, that he takes his punishment for, you know, basically stealing his woman.
And I think that it is beautiful. He's the one who made it known to Leo. And I think...
Right. And it's a form of confession, too.
And he's conflicted throughout.
Yeah.
I think he's got two motives. He actually does, in some sense, want this woman. And in some sense, is using her to try to get to Leo, to get Leo to look at sense. And in some ways, the advice that he gives Casper is sound, but always to the end of helping Leo. And poor Casper is led down the road, and Tom plays him like a fool. But he, I mean, Tom brings it all off. He to the end is loyal to Leo, even when it all busts out.
Okay, but I'm going to go far afield now, and this is just a flight of fancy. This is wholly original and may not come to anything as I say it.
Yeah.
It strikes me that everything turns around for you know, Tom's trying to help Leo, gets him in a bad... Leo gets himself in a bad spot because of his love for Verna and his foolishness, perhaps, his imprudence. Tom gets Leo in a bad spot through his entanglements and his failure to, you know, off the schmata when he has the chance, right? When Tom confesses to Leo, that's when everything turns around for Tom and Leo in the movie. Is there anything to that?
Well, yeah, and the fact that he was willing to admit his wrongdoing.
He admits it, he gets his punishment, and everything turns around.
But it was also, as Leo said at the end of the movie, you know, oh, you just did that so that it would look like there was... I mean, he used it as a way to get in with Casper.
It was part of his prudence, but maybe in some thematic way it actually helped to turn things
on. He never lied to Leo. In no scene, in no line of dialogue or ever, did he ever lie. Even when Leo shows up at his apartment looking for Verna, and Verna's in the other room.
Yeah, he doesn't specifically
lie. Tom never does. Never lies about it. And I believe that in that scene, if Leo said, is Verna here, he would have said yes.
Exactly, yeah. He is truly a dutiful servant.
And he's just the ultimate cool guy. I mean, he is totally cool.
So many cool guys. I mean, it's just the whole thing is so cool. Yeah. The movie is a pleasure to watch. It might be the movie of the Coens that I enjoy watching the most. It's not my favorite. It's not their best, in my opinion, for some of the limitations that I'm discussing here in this milieu and all that other thing. But it might be my favorite to watch.
I think it's terrific.
Now, where does it rank, Tim? You've discussed it at length now. Where does it rank in your all-time Coen Brothers movies? Not your favorite.
Mm-hmm.
I know it's your favorite.
But
in the best.
Go. Okay, I'm going to go and rank that number one. It is their best movie ever.
You really think it's better than...
I do.
Fargo?
Yep.
You think it's better than True Grit?
Yes.
You really think it's better... Really? Than yes. No Country?
Yes.
Really?
Yes.
No Country for Old Men I'm talking about?
Yes.
You know the movie?
Yes. It's way good.
So I'm assuming you're going to give it 10 the Timmins.
It's gooder than Goody Gooderson.
From Goodton?
Near Goodwardsville.
Married to Goody Goodwife?
Yeah.
All right, well, go ahead and give it out to me.
The Tin Man, 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 the Tin Man. Yeah!
Folks, Tim's dead wrong here. That's not unusual, but it is in my top four Coen Brothers movies ever, and it is, for me, a 10 out of 10 for sure.
Look at you.
But that's because it's a Coen Brothers movie that's in the top four. Of course it's 10 out of 10.
I have seen some other movies that aren't Coen Brothers movies, including Whit Stillman movies.
Really? Who's Whit Stillman again?
He made Metropolitan, which is really a lovable epic about debutante.
I'm sorry, I would have belled him earlier, but my soul was just crushed. How can you do this to me?
I love that movie.
Yeah, and me too. It's great. It's a great movie, isn't it?
Yeah.
Wow.
We ought to do a podcast on that.
Wow. We will. We will. We're holding off because I don't want to just, you know, put out my best podcast and be done. I want to end on a high note.
Bingo.
That's definitely going to be the climax of podcasts.
Love it. Is my
Hello?
Hey there.
Oh, hi.
Hi, it's me, your husband.
Hi, husband.
You know, I was just calling to check on how your day's going and everything.
It's peachy.
Have you ever seen that movie Miller's Crossing?
Funny you should ask. Yes. Yes, I've seen it.
Did you like that?
Yeah, I don't remember anything about it.
So, wow. Another great podcast in the books, Tim. Another great... day in the books.
I think history will be the judge.
Yeah. So watch Miller's Crossing. Watch The Potty Mouth. It's not a family film. And we'll join you next week on the Catholic Movie Guy podcast. Tim, any parting shots?
Party on, Wayne.
Why do you do that?
I don't know.
All right, cool.